Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Grant Street Experience. I'm your host, Grant Urban, Chief Resilience Officer here at the City of Pittsburgh. Good to see everybody here and listening in from far and wide for our first show of 2021. And we're starting the season off right with a great friend and colleague and mentor, Patty DeMarco. Patty, how are you this morning?
I'm wonderful, thank you, on this gray January Pittsburgh day.
Yeah, it's we've had a few here. I mean, for folks listening in other parts of the country and everything, it, you know, majority of the time the sun shines in Pittsburgh, so we've only had a couple of gray days here, right? Patty, you know, just a little bit of background for our audience. You're a noted author, educator, local government professional, and a few other hats that you wear that I'm probably leaving out. So we're really excited to talk to you about kind of your work and a book that you put together called Pathways to Our Sustainable Future, which we'll get into in a little bit. But maybe just to start off, if you could kind of introduce yourself, you know, to the audience and who you are and what you do.
Hi, I'm a native of Pittsburgh. I was born and raised here. My father was in the Foreign Service. So while I was young, we traveled all over the world. And that gave me kind of a global perspective to my life. But I'm pretty much an Italian first generation person, bridged the patriarchal Italian family into the women's lib movement. That was my generation. I'm a biologist by training, a Rachel Carson scholar, and I have been in the energy and environmental policy field since 1975 continuously. I've been in the regulatory arena as commissioner, and I was the demand side manager for a municipal electric cooperative for many years. I teach science, ethics, and public policy. I started at Pitt and teach at Chatham now. And I've had the honor of being elected to serve as a borough council member in the borough of Forest Hills.
That's terrific.
Currently as their vice president.
What's, you know, when I first met you, it was through your work with the Rachel Carson Homestead. Mm-hmm. And you have a history well before that, that maybe if you talk a little bit about your role in Alaska. That was one of the things when I first met you, I was really fascinated by, here's a Pittsburgh girl in Alaska. How'd you get there? And maybe talk about some of that work, because it's really fascinating.
Well, I came to Pittsburgh after spending 10 years in Alaska. I had gone there after my divorce because it was as far away as I could get from my ex and still be in the U.S. So I went from Connecticut to Alaska, and I spent 10 years there. I didn't intend to, but it's the kind of place that really absorbs you. And I found that, for me anyway, the glass ceiling broke there. I'm president of the Economic Development Corporation. I became a commissioner of the regulated utilities, one of five commissioners. And I had the opportunity to travel extensively in the state as part of my duties and also as part of my advocacy. I really enjoyed having a chance to meet people. And I learned so much from especially meeting a number of the indigenous peoples who befriended me, either because I got fogged in and couldn't leave, like happened at St. Mary when we went there for a hearing and we got fogged in for 3 days. And there were only, I was the only woman in the delegation. There were two engineers and a paralegal, and Mary Thomas came up to me, and she was one of the elders of the community. She said, you can't stay here with all these men. There's no hotel there. It was okay. Just a community room. And she said, you're going to come home with us.
Right.
So they held a potluck for me.
Oh, that's
and
awesome.
All the women came and they brought food and they made me dance, the native dance. They gave me a little pair of fans, which I should have thought to bring to you if I knew you were going to talk about this. But it was amazing because they're such warm, wonderful people, but still living in many areas in subsistence lifestyles with extreme challenges right now because of climate undermining and eroding traditional ways. And it's a really interesting time to see how transformations happen.
Where were you based at in Alaska?
I was in Anchorage, but in Anchorage, all over the world and all over Alaska, you know, when I was there.
And I mean, it's literally a wild place.
It are. there are no roads, there are no maps. I mean, it's a state that would cover a third of the land mass of the lower 48 if you lined up the Bering Sea with Lake Superior, and it has fewer paved roads than the state of Rhode Island.
And how did your time there really kind of, I guess, hone or kind of deepen your interest in environmental policy?
Well, it was clear to me, first of all, that people who look at seven generations for impact policy decisions really understand in a very visceral way that the health of the environment is really the health of the people. Mm. And I really was very impressed with things like deciding to put in a telecommunications tower, for example, would get the seven generations view. Well, we've never had such a thing here. Why do we need it now? And what does it give us? You know, and we had these long discussions about the implications of changing, you know, basic ways of being. Mm-hmm. And the argument around the Pebble Creek mine, which you may have heard about, is one that really brought that to light, because there are so many thousands and thousands of communities and villages in the Bristol Bay drainage that depend on the anadromous fishes of the salmon migration.
Okay.
And though the Pebble Creek mine is a gold mine and it will release arsenic when you mine it, mm-hmm. arsenic is highly soluble in water and it is extremely toxic to fish in very, very minute doses. So even, you know, all the protections that they say would happen, you know, even one spill could just wipe out the entire Bristol Bay fishery, which supports thousands of people, you know, not just in Alaska, but because they export the fish. It's a huge.
Right.
So understanding the cascading effects of ecosystem disruptions when a good quarter of the economy of that state depends on tourism and fisheries, it's really a much more connected argument than when you're sitting in a 15-foot story building with concrete all around you and you don't really recognize that you're in a living environment as part of your habitat. You know, your perspective is really different.
That's interesting, yeah, because people are literally connected to nature. Yes. Because their livelihoods oftentimes, you know, depend upon it, right?
Yes, yes.
What,
I brought that back to Pittsburgh because I grew up here, and when I left Alaska, I could have gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. My daughter was in Virginia at that time. My sister was in Tennessee, but I grew up in Pittsburgh and I was in desperate need to come back to my roots. I was pretty beat up when I left Alaska.
I was going to say, like, what brought you back?
Well, two things. One, I had a grandchild in Virginia, and it's a long, long way from Alaska to Virginia.
Right.
Secondly, my father died, and I was not able to get here in time to say goodbye because I couldn't get on a plane. I finally was given a seat in a jump seat of the FedEx cargo carriers because my friend who ran the cargo station said, well, Patty, we can put you on a jump seat, because I couldn't get a flight out of Anchorage in April for love.
Wow.
And so I didn't make it home before he died, but that started thinking. And then I realized that, you know, life is pretty short. You know, I had a bout with cancer and I thought, good heavens, here I am way up here in the far north and my entire family is on the East Coast and this is just not working for me. And once you have grandchildren, to see them once or twice a year just didn't cut it for me at all. So I came home.
That's a pretty important draw. So it's not just like the connection to nature, but and we've learned this through the pandemic, right? The connection to people and family and how important it is.
And it was also coming back to my roots. I mean, Rachel Carson was my hero from the time I graduated from high school. And when I was in Alaska, I challenged the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. I wrote a conservation policy for the state that was not accepted, but it was a real battle. I left pretty beat up. Mm-hmm. you know, because it's an oil industry dominated policy world. And I was a regulatory commissioner saying no to things that they wanted to do.
Right.
And even though the big case on the Trans-Alaska pipeline where the challenge to the rate case was upheld by the Supreme Court, I didn't get reappointed over that decision because I wrote a 25-page dissent that became the majority position. Somebody flipped.
Wow.
So we ended up with a really vehement battle over the Trans-Alaska pipeline tariffs and, you know, who had the right to use it and all these things, very complicated technical stuff. But, you know, you haven't lived until you've sat through 7 days of depreciation testimony.
Right.
It's like, okay, I'm done. You know, I reloaded the drawing caricatures of the lawyers to keep awake because it was just...
You know? Every time I give testimony to things, I always like just, you know, give my appreciation to the hearing regulators because, oh, yeah. Like, you know, it is definitely a skill and a battle of endurance to kind of
really have to depend on the expertise of your staff, you know, because if you don't, but you have to read what they write too. And I mean, it's really important to,
right,
in a regulatory position to really read the record and understand the issues. And that's what I teach right now is how do you go about making public policy decisions in these complex issues that we have to deal with today.
I want to come back to that in a minute, but maybe if you could talk a little bit about your time with the Rachel Carson Homestead and Rachel Carson herself and what she's meant to you. I think, you know, for our audience, it's kind of a broad-based group. So maybe a little bit about Rachel, her role in not just being a Pittsburgher, a person from the region, but what she's meant to the environmental movement.
Well, Rachel Carson, you know, was born and raised in Springdale, and she went to Pennsylvania College for Women, which is now Chatham University. Mm-hmm. She was a graduate of the class of 1929, and her work in really promulgating an environmental ethic that is based on protecting and precaution in protecting the environment from man-made activities, including synthetic chemicals like pesticides and herbicides, mm-hmm. was really seminal in the environmental movement. She was also a real role model for women in science. She was the first woman who was hired as a scientist in the government, mm-hmm. Fish and Wildlife Service, and she served there for many years, was the editor of all of the science publications that came out of there, including the Conservation in Action papers, which really laid down some of the fundamental policies of our public parks, our wildlife mm-hmm. refuges, the Endangered Species Act. All of those things, you know, really can be attributed to her influence on really foundational environmental law. And really her activism, not only as a writer, but also as a person. She wrote extensively letters, testimony, speeches, telling people that you cannot sit quiet when you see mm-hmm. harms, and making sure that we understand that we are part of the living earth.
Mm-hmm.
The life support system that we depend on really depends on the functioning ecosystems that support the fresh air, the clean water, the fertile ground, and the biodiversity of species, of which we are only one part. So that interconnectedness of people with all of the mm-hmm. living parts of the earth was really a critical message that she gave. And when I was at the Rachel Carson Homestead, I was really fortunate to have the opportunity of that bully pulpit during the centennial celebration in 2007. I'd only been here a year. But we started a series of Rachel Carson Legacy conferences, and I think we did 8 or 9 of them.
I remember
that.
I did
2 more at Chatham. And we called together people from all over the world. I mean, E.O. Wilson came, you know, Francesco Santoro from UNESCO. I mean, we had really outstanding convenings of discussion. We did a discussion session on green chemistry, which Terry Collins at CMU Institute for Green Science was really helpful with. We had Paul Anastas and all the people who were real key formers of the idea that you can prevent the formation of toxic materials by design. and putting that forward as a concept and finding that Pittsburgh is actually a center for green chemistry in the country. There are more green chemistry award recipients in this city than anywhere except for Stanford in California. And almost all of those are academic, and there are some in industry and some in academia. So Rachel Carson really, she was a major force in my life as a role model and as an inspiration. Her writing is still really very prescient of the problems that we're facing today, which is why I quoted her so much in my book. and really, her environmental ethic, I think, still offers a great deal to us in both humanitarian and environmental guidance.
You mentioned that, and you know, it picks up in the book too. I mean, so maybe let's transition into that because, you know, the first section around like the living earth and the connection between people and earth and living systems, like that is the embodiment of Rachel Carson. It's interesting to hear you talk about it and then having, you know, kind of read it in the book. So the book, Pathways to Our Sustainable Future, A Global Perspective from Pittsburgh. And I should tell you too, that two reasons we wanted to talk to you about this is we were pinged by some of our listeners about local authors and the role of local authors in helping to shape decisions and to use Pittsburgh as a model. And so one of the things we've been doing on the show is just bringing local authors on to talk about both the content of the books, but also the process of writing. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you could start with that, because Pittsburgh is a character in your book, in the region. And maybe if you could start there with, like, you know, the inspiration and how the book started to come together in your mind.
Well, first of all, I was teaching for 7 years, science, ethics, and public policy, and in various forms, both at Pitt and at Chatham. And I've given a lot of lectures, both from the Rachel Carson Homestead and the Rachel Carson Institute. And when I retired from having a formal position in 2012.
Retired, Patty.
Right, I know it didn't work, but but I didn't have a formal employer, let's say. I found that I had become in the habit of having handouts to give out to people after I give speeches or to give to my class. And then when I'm talking, I often only have like 15, 20 minutes. You don't have time to give a whole exposition of what you'd like to say. You can only give people a tease. And I didn't have anything to leave behind. So that was one thing. The other thing was that I realized that we were at a really critical time in our course of history where sustainability was a really important matter and climate change is really marching upon us. Mm-hmm. And I was looking for what makes people get engaged in this issue and become not just aware of it, but willing to take action. And I find that what actually helps the most is the stories. You need to have people connect to something they can relate to personally.
Mm-hmm. It's so, how people learn, right?
Yes. And there are all kinds of books out there on sustainability. I've got stacks of them, you know, where best practices, you see bookshelves full of them. Best practices, and they go from all over the world, and they give you, you know, all kinds of examples and, you know, protocols and models and everything. But I thought, you know, Pittsburgh is really at the fulcrum point of this transition from the fossil age to the renewable and sustainable age that is coming. And how is a particular place at a particular point in time coping with this transition? What are we doing that is actually working? And to give people some examples, you can't move to something you can't visualize. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about, you know, we're going to have a renewable energy future, and, you know, Amory Lovins writes all these elaborate models and, you know, extrapolations, and people put models of all kinds of things for it, but people don't connect to that kind of thing in the abstract. If you say to them, hey, look, we've got a living building that's the best in the world. It's right here in Pittsburgh. You can go see it. It's right over there.
Right. Right here.
You know, if you say to people, you know, farming doesn't have to be destructive. It can be regenerative. Go over here where we have a whole urban farm, and you can go look at it and see it. You know, mm-hmm. that I think resonates to people, and it resonated with my students. When I was teaching, I would have people come in and talk. I had you come in and talk,
yeah.
you know, about what are we doing to, you know, make renewable energy happen in the city? And, mm-hmm. you know, how do we negotiate for renewable energy contracts so that the price comes down? And these kinds of things are more tangible when people can visualize them in right where they are.
It's important so too. And for a little bit about like each of the arc that you tell in the book, I thought was really interesting because, you know, you have, you know, the first sec, maybe if you can talk about each section, but like the living earth and how we're connected and some of the stories that you bring up, and then you hit innovation and then, you know, kind of the social cultural impediments that we face.
Yeah.
How did you come up with that arc and maybe talk about each of the sections and some of the things that you highlight?
Well, first of all, the whole thing came from Rachel Carson's environmental ethics. So connecting to the living earth and coming down to really what is our life support system. If we're going to mm-hmm. be existing on this earth for seven generations more, we have to preserve our air, our water, the fertile ground, and the other creatures that support our life. Because without that, no amount of money is going to save you, you know. And I think about that banner that is carried down the streets on the anti-fracking movement, you can't drink money.
Yeah.
You know, that's really true, you know.
Right.
And people lose sight of that. So I wanted to put, also, you save what you care about. And so making that connection to the living earth and not just the ethic of it, but also how you teach and introduce people to being connected, how mm-hmm. you engage children, and what do you benefit from by doing that? So that whole sense of wonder that happens from being part of nature and seeing yourself as part of the natural world is really where it starts from. Because once you do that, once you connect people to that sense that was endemic in the Alaska Native communities, they didn't see themselves as different from the living earth. You're part of it.
How would you juxtapose, I guess, you know, people in the urban environment versus the folks that you encountered in your experiences in Alaska?
Well, you know, when you have a beautiful, bright spring day, how everybody's spirit kind of lifts that mm-hmm. first really warm spring day when you walk outside and you can hear the birds and the flowers start to come, that sense of uplift.
Yeah.
Even if you're a city dweller, you feel that, right?
And right.
I think that was what I was trying to do. I describe a walk through the strip district, you know, a sensory walk through the mm-hmm. strip district, just showing how you're really connected to the places where you live and just becoming aware of the things around you. And you can see the effort that we've made in Pittsburgh. It's a biophilic city, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it received an award for that. We've very consciously brought the greening into the city because it does help people to be connected to nature. When you're walking down the street on Oliver Avenue or Forbes Avenue and you encounter birds in the area and you mm-hmm. have flowers and trees, and even in the winter trees, you know, you find a respite from the press and the intrusion of the technology and of the world around us, so that it gives you a way to remember that you're human, you know?
I think that's one of the things that's been, I talked about this on a different episode, but, you know, one of the things in the early days of the pandemic when, you know, everything really was kind of compressed and suppressed, and you started to see things change in our natural environment, right? You know, whether it was the ability to literally like smell or to hear, and how when those different kind of sensory experiences are able to be expanded, it was really fascinating. Because, you know, we go about our daily lives and we just kind of, you know, bounce around, right? And you take so much for granted, but like that sensory experience is really amazing, right?
It is. And you know, the other thing that I think is important to recognize is that if you're connected to the natural world and see yourself as part of the living part of the world, not the built part, you recognize that we're more alike as people, as humans, mm-hmm. than we are different in, you know, culture or faith or gender or even politics. You know, people have the common animal comfort creature needs.
Right.
We share as humans. And I think when you're aware of your place in the natural world, it's easier to remember that what we need as people is what we have in common, and how we behave to each other in community is what makes us human and makes civilization possible. Right. So I find that the, you know, using nature as a touchstone is really a good foundation for things, especially when you're trying to build transformations. Mm-hmm. Because when you're trying to move from one way of doing things and transform it into a different way of doing things, you have to keep what is essential,
right,
and is critical to survival intact, and bring that thread through so that people don't get disoriented and disconnected and dysfunctional.
It's fascinating because, you know, you talked a little bit about Pittsburgh's role in green chemistry, yeah, which is really one of the foundations of kind of Rachel Carson's legacy. Yeah. Your second component of the book was talking about innovation.
Yeah.
What were some things that really kind of, I guess, stick out for you in kind of this Pittsburgh ecosystem about the role of innovation, where you're kind of like, oh, wow. You know, like, what were the things that made Patty say, like, oh, wow, this is really some cool stuff that we're working on?
One is, we really are one of the centers of innovation in green chemistry, as I pointed out. Lily Tordia has done tremendous things commercially.
Yeah.
He's making hand sanitizer out of hemp now, okay? I mean, this man is amazing. But we have...
This is Lalit from Thar Industries, right? He does some cool stuff.
I did a case study on him, and he's gone way beyond where it was in the book now. You know, his whole enterprise is forward, keeps spinning them out. But that kind of innovation springs from the fact we have 8 accredited universities in the city of Pittsburgh. And unlike places like Boston, they actually talk to each other. They collaborate with each other. They collaborate with public entities like the city of Pittsburgh deliberately. Mm-hmm. And that is not routine everywhere. Mm. Believe me, I've been in places where the universities are at war with each other. And even, you know, you can't go to seminars across the aisles from each other. Ridiculous. Here we share. And the Rachel Carson conferences were all planned with multi-university planning teams.
Right.
As well as industry and nonprofit groups. The planning projects were really exciting by themselves, never mind the conference output. But that was one thing that really led to that whole discussion about a different way of materials management that addresses reducing the risk itself, reducing the inherent hazard instead of the dose that you're exposed to.
Right.
And so that fundamental shift of the way we look at how we design and create things, and finding examples where we actually are doing that, such as Lily. Secondly, was the energy transformation that's going on.
Yeah.
We're right in the middle of the Marcellus Shale, but we're also at one of the centers of design for the microgrid, for the technologies for increasing the nodal distribution in like neural networks of command and control of artificial intelligence in load management, and energy innovation in systems. I mean, the wind stacks, you know, this is a real revolution. It only needs 5 miles an hour of wind. You can put it in neighborhoods, you can put it on top of buildings, and it's all made with a local supply chain.
Right here. Yeah.
I think veterans and, you know, preference hiring local people. This is amazing. And it's doing amazingly well. It's gone way beyond where it was in the few examples they had in my book. And the third one is the concept of agriculture as part of the resilient community of the regenerative economy, where food isn't something that comes from far away, packaged and plasticked and whatever, but you grow it in your neighborhood.
Right.
And Pittsburgh has a huge tradition of that. I mean, way back from when I was a child in the 50s, the Victory Gardens were still evident everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
From World War II. A lot of them are still here. You can drive around in the south side, in the north side, and everywhere and find, okay, some of them are now parking spaces, But you see the remnants of the grapevines, you see the remnants of, and people have returned to that. And you've made some great strides in the city of Pittsburgh. Your urban agriculture regulation is amazing. Even allowing bees, chickens, and miniature goats. I mean, this is amazing. But having urban agriculture as part of the built environment, as part of our living space, mm-hmm. it also helps you capture carbon. It gives you a sense of community around shared food production, just as it was when I was a girl. I mean, all the aunties and I grew up in Mount Washington on Lilia Street. And there were only two properties where they were owned by people who thought they were going to have a lawn. Everybody else had, you know, tomato plants and zucchini, and the grapes grew up to the second floor, and the fruit trees were along the borders, and all the children were conscripted labor all summer, running around from one farm to the other, and Matilda and Bernice and Mrs. Nachola, everybody, all the kids worked.
It's one of those things too. We had Shelley Danko Day, who's on the team, who leads our food policy work. You know, it's fascinating. Two things. One, you know, the amount of the ability to connect people to local food so important to the transition, because that is, like you're saying, it's the core community, right? Like how we can connect, how we communicate, sharing recipes, or, you know, hey, I had a couple extra tomatoes. Do you want to take them off my hand? It's such a human experience and so important, but also, you know, one of the things that we've challenged or found is the challenge with regard to food insecurity.
Yes.
And, you know, the number of people, which is around 20% of folks in the county, don't know where their next meal is going to come from.
And it's getting worse with COVID.
It's getting worse in the pandemic. It's certainly true. And that kind of leads a little bit into like the third section, which are like these social and cultural impediments. Yep. How do we... And in the book, you find a couple of examples, but how do you start to kind of break down the social and cultural barriers that exist in order to start to foster the connections, which also lead to innovation? I mean, what are some of your thoughts there?
Well, I think one of the things that I find really exciting about Pittsburgh is that people really care about each other. We have a lot of nonprofit organizations that have been endowed by the legacy of our industrial past. Mm-hmm. The people who built their wealth gave back in the form of nonprofit endowments. And those really have given us, like the universities have given us the intellectual capital, they've given us the social capital to really reach into new ways of solving old problems. Mm. So you mentioned food deserts. Well, having that identified as an issue, and then having urban agriculture, I mean, Grow Pittsburgh, Urban Kind Institute, the Forbes Foundation, all of these people really have made ways to connect to the community in meaningful improvements that make their life better. Mm-hmm. And the land bank process that's going on with the TRICOG, the three community,
the tri-borough council of governments.
That council of governments, it's a long complicated name, but you know, Ann Lewis has done a great job there, taking, you know, blighted property and turning them to a better use. And sometimes that means demolishing it and putting in open space, demolishing, you know, derelict buildings that can't be retrieved and putting in agricultural space. Mm-hmm. Now we have still some challenges in maintaining those spaces when other development pressures see a more cost-efficient or cost-benefit approach, or the ownership changes. So how do you protect land that's been reclaimed for farming? And I know the Allegheny Land Trust is very active on that, and there are a number of other organizations, including FIPS, that work on that problem of, once you've retrieved fertile ground, how do you preserve it as a community mm-hmm. asset? And so we're getting to this discussion about the valuation of land and the historic process of saying that mineral rights have primacy over surface rights, which goes back to 1837, is coming under severe challenge now.
Yeah.
And in Virginia, this has been going on across the state. And, you know, Act 31, which says you must give access whether you want to or not. I mean, we've challenged that in our town. I know Pittsburgh has.
Yeah.
You know, for fracking. I mean, we banned it outright. Well, you can't ban it outright because the law says you must. Okay, fine. You can have this little place, not even as big as a football field, that we'll define that as the only place you can be. We're a 1.5 square mile town, okay?
There's These no are the place. Zoning requirements,
There's
right?
There's a zoning requirement. Yeah, but if you go 200 feet in any direction, you just can't. There's no room. So we had to make an ordinance that was artificially constrained like that because we're required by the state law. But these things need to continue to come up and be challenged. And when you have people taking the initiative to say, we have better uses for this land. We don't think the houses belong in the floodplain. Why can't we use it for farm space? Because it's going to flood and that would be good for the ground rather than bad for it if there are houses on it. And begin to take account of how we are related to the real, you know, natural forces of the land. The laws of nature are not negotiable. They will prevail. And so we might as well begin planning around those, you know, constraints and building community to have that work.
And you've seen that too, I think. And that there is a bit of a, I'm gonna call it an awakening of sorts. I mean, I think it's been there for a long time, but more and more people are becoming aware of these challenges and how they affect their built natural environment and ultimately their health. And you talk a little bit about this in the book too, maybe just to kind of transition a bit into, you know, how do we move forward? But the idea of like community engagement and kind of the, you know, the back in 2013 when Mayor Peduto won election, you were a part of the community transition team. Mm-hmm. So you've experienced kind of, you know, that arc. That's bringing us into like the current future where we're at. I mean, what are your reflections, I guess, over the last, you know, five to 7 years, but then also more importantly, some of these things going forward, we're at a really critical juncture, as you know, not just as a city, but as a you know, as humanity.
Well, I think you can't underestimate the value of a visionary leader. And we've seen a time of great contrasts in that, where, you know, when Mayor Peduto came in, he had this broad community visioning process, he had some really broad goals, very ambitious ones to make Pittsburgh a shining example of a resilient, sustainable city. And I think in a lot of ways, we've gone there. We've achieved that. You know, we've been recognized nationally, internationally, even for making strides in that direction. Mm-hmm. From where you sit down in the hustings, it looks like it's pretty pitiful in terms of what actually happens because it's so slow and because we have a lot of old buildings and old infrastructure. And, you know, it's like a big battleship, you know, when you're trying to change direction, a lot of churning happens for a long time before you see any visible motion, right? So we're in the churn, okay? We're in the churning stage right now. We haven't seen a lot of motion, but without that vision of moving people from being aware of what the possibilities are, mm-hmm. seeing how, oh, this is something I can actually participate in. And here's my path to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, giving people those on-ramps for engagement. And I think the Black Lives Matter movement has brought a lot of that forward, saying, hey, it isn't fair. You know, mm-hmm. that some people have different opportunities than other people just from where they live or what they look like. Mm-hmm. And beginning to put those things into the public policy arena and dissect them, it's a painful process, but it has to happen. And I think it is happening in Pittsburgh in really productive and exciting ways. And I think that's largely because the mayor has made space for that to go forward. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't happen everywhere, okay? But it can happen here.
It can happen here, yeah.
And the other thing I think that's really critical to understand is that do not underestimate the value of having the intellectual capital that not only is invested in the universities, but also in the foundation community. Mm-hmm. It is a legacy of our industrial past in some ways. and it has constraints in some places because of that. But it also is a testimony to the vision of some of those people whose, you know, after effects weren't always positive to the environment and to the people, but having the vision to say, we want to endow the future where it will, and have, you know, the Heinz Endowments and the R.K. Mellon Foundation, the Forbes Funds, all these people, the Pittsburgh Foundation, there to give resources for exploration of things that don't necessarily happen everywhere. I think that's another reason Pittsburgh is really on the forefront of this transformation that we're seeing in society.
That's interesting. We got a few minutes left here. Yeah. And one of the things I wanted to hit upon is, you know, you have, as I mentioned in the onset, you have multiple hats that you wear as an educator, author, but also as an advocate. And one of the things I wanted to tie together is kind of your role in advocacy with the Reimagine Appalachia campaign, if you could talk a little bit about that. But also concurrently, you're in the position of being the new chair of CONNECT, or the Congress of Neighboring Communities. And, you know, we've had some really great conversations with Lydia Morin and the team at CONNECT, and some of the local municipalities, such as yourself in Forest Hills, who are building their own climate action plans. Mm-hmm. You know, so there's this regional kind of meta regional thing that we have shaping up, but also kind of the on the ground, boots on the ground kind of climate action. So maybe start first with the Reimagine work.
Yeah.
For listeners, explain, what is the Reimagine Appalachia campaign?
Okay. Well, there are four states in the Ohio River Valley, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky, that have been assaulted by this proposed petrochemical buildout, moving the Gulf, you know, coast petro industry inland away from the hurricanes and disruption of the Gulf Coast. But at the same time, people are looking at a future that isn't based on fossil fuels, that isn't based on extractive industries, that isn't going to go through the boom and bust that has, you know, assaulted our communities for so many decades, and saying, let's think about what we could do if we look at what people actually want where they are. Mm-hmm. And it's been a grassroots effort bubbling up through, initially the Reimagine process was done through the League of Women Voters. And we did them in Lehigh and in Erie and Beaver and Butler, in Wheeling, West Virginia. And now we're doing it as a joint effort across four states, where we had listening sessions and talked about, what do people want to do? What do you see as a vision for the future? What do you want to explore? Mm-hmm. And the Reimagine Blueprint has really three main components, which is, you know, based on equity and inclusion and unions and putting people back to work where they are, and looking at ways that we can go forward with an economy that actually works for a broader base of people than the past approach. So modernizing manufacturing, building out broadband, and investing in regenerative agriculture in these rural areas, to use that as a way to recapture the fertility of the land and heal the land and heal the people. So that initiative has really gathered a lot of momentum. We're now going to be joined by the mayors of the Middle America Marshall Plan. Mm-hmm. And I think this can be a really spearhead of our national approach to moving and transforming to a regenerative, renewable, sustainable society, because it has the needs and interests of the working people and the people in communities, and says, invest in the communities, invest in the entrepreneurship, in the ideas that will sustain long-term prosperity, not this boom stuff that mostly sends money to multinational corporations out of the country.
Right. But it's been fascinating.
Own communities.
It's been fascinating to me in working with you and others in this project, the sense of connectivity and community across the four states.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're talking about Cincinnati or Louisville or Morgantown, West Virginia, or Huntington, West Virginia, or Pittsburgh or Youngstown, There is a sense of connectedness, literally like the river runs through it, you know, and there is a shared ethos and value set that you touch upon in terms of the bottom up approach, but also the need to have a voice.
Yes. And that's, I ended my book on the power of joined voices, which is kind of a takeoff from The Power of One Voice, which was the film we made about Rachel Carson. But, you know, when you have people who have a common vision of the future and are willing to roll up their sleeves and work for it, I mean, when you get the mayors of four states coming together and going to Congress, as we are planning to do, say to them, this is what we need in our communities so that we can be whole and healthy and prosper together. And, you know, to go together with people from your neighboring states and show the regional impact of collaboration, it is a very powerful force. It's energizing. It makes people excited when you get people in a room together and they say, yeah, you know, we've been growing tobacco in the markets, like, get it. Nobody's going to, but if you grow hemp, first of all, there are 13 species of hemp, by the way. Only one of them makes you high. The rest of them are really, really interesting and important sources of fiber and all kinds of other plastic substitutes.
Yeah.
And the same infrastructure that you use for tobacco harvesting, drying sheds, shading, all that
stuff,
you use for hemp. So it's an immediate substitution. Plus, it has a much more positive effect on the ground because it's deeper rooted, it needs less water, and it has a regenerative aspect in its planting process.
So it's better for the soil then.
Better for the soil. Yeah. So this kind of thing, to me, you know, when you talk to farmers and they're saying, we don't have a cash crop that works for us, we can't compete with the multi-ag people. But when you get a multi-product kind of thing, when you look at permaculture practices and have the land be part of our carbon solution, I think you get a lot of conjoining of intention.
Yeah. And
when you find that you have four of the main states of the country working together on this, and there's similar initiatives going on in the Southwest, there's some in Florida, there's some in Northeast, in Maine. And if they all come together and say, if you invest in communities instead of rich people and top corporations, guess what? Bottom up fertilizes and everything grows from the bottom up.
It's a great point. Just to finish up the bottom up, the other bottom up piece is kind of the work with Connect and the Congress of Neighboring Communities. And you know, one of the things that you guys have started to lead is the development of climate plans with, you know, the surrounding local municipalities surrounding the city of Pittsburgh. Maybe quickly kind of talk a little bit about that process and kind of where you guys are in Forest Hills, for example.
Well, we were lucky. We were one of the first 20 in the D.C. and in the state and Ikeley Collaboration for Climate Action Support for a pilot project. So there are four of us in the Pittsburgh area that were in that first batch. And Forest Hills was one, Aetna was another, and we're both in Connect. So when we realized that what you can do by yourself as a town of 5,600 people isn't a lot, but if you're with your neighbors and if you're with your hub city, you have now practically doubled the impact that we can have together, because the communities immediately around Pittsburgh are about 80% of Pittsburgh alone. So if you add it together, it's almost double. And that means that you can do things like joint planning for things like zoning, building standards, emissions controls, expediting non-motorized transportation across town borders. All kinds of things become possible when you're working together as a group. So I'm very excited to be doing this. I know you've been piloting and leading the way on the climate action plan for Pittsburgh for a long time, and that certainly is helpful. But imagine how you can double the impact you're having if all of your neighbors are doing the same thing. So it's really exciting to see that happen.
It really is exciting. And you know, just a quick note, and a hat tip to Dave Miller. And this is really, I think, a key component of Dave, who was the full disclosure, a former professor of mine at the Graduate School of Public International Affairs, and a real leader in this space in forming Connect. And I think, you know, this is what he talked about, Pittsburgh and the also urbs, the also urban communities, where we have this shared space and our ability to work together, like Dave used to talk about, creates a cumulative impact. And in the climate space in particular, exactly. There's a lot of great opportunities that we can share together. With that, Patty, I just want to thank you so much. This has been a terrific conversation. We could probably go on for hours. And I know that we'll continue the conversation offline. But I want to
buy my book. I'd be happy to sign one for them. You can get one on my webpage. I'm sorry. You can get it at patriciadimarco.com. And if you want a signed copy, just let me know.
Super terrific. And we'll point people to that and share this around and everything so that they can learn more about your work, as well as pathways to our sustainable future and all the good stuff that you do. So thanks, Patty. And let's have a great 2021. And we'll be talking with you soon.
Okay. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks.